Tonight's reading is from Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 2, and beginning at verse 13. And we also thank God constantly for this, that when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you accepted it, not as the word of men, but as what it really is, the word of God, which is at work in you, believers. For you, brothers, became imitators of the churches of God in Christ Jesus that are in Judea. For you suffer the same things from your own countrymen as they did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets and drove us out, and displease God and oppose all mankind by hindering us from speaking to the Gentiles that they might be saved, so as always to fill up the measure of their sins. But God's wrath has come upon them at last. But since we were torn away from you, brothers, for a short time, in person, not in heart, we endeavored the more eagerly and with great desire to see you face to face, because we wanted to come to you. I, Paul, again and again, but Satan hindered us. For what is our hope, or joy, or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at this coming? Is it not you? For you are our glory and joy.
I hope I will just inspire you a little bit this evening with this period of history that we sort of often don't know about. So we kind of know about Charles I, we kind of know about Cromwell, and then we kind of know a bit about Whitfield and Wesley, and there's this sort of this blob in the middle. Where we don't really know what happened. That's a picture up there of, who knows? Who knows who that's a picture of? Yes, I heard somebody say. William of Orange. Yes, thank you. William III. See the banner there? It says the protector of liberty. And so here we were, William of Orange, 1688, and it was seen, that's a sort of the stylized picture of him being invited into England, and seen as a protector of liberty. And one of the things we're going to try and unpack this evening, is how we get from the end of the Cromwellian period through to this period of William of Orange and the apparent protector of our liberties, the pluses and the minuses, the move away from oppression towards toleration, and yet it still left us as Christians with a number of deep complexities. But hopefully that will become clear as we go. And it was the 29th of May, 1660, that Charles II made his triumphant royal entry into London in order to reclaim his throne. Less than 1 month earlier, a special parliament which had been convened, called the Convention Parliament, had voted to restore the Stuart monarchy. Now, I can tell you, if you were one of the Puritans at that time, you may well have had, shall we say, mixed feelings about what was taking place. You see, on the morning of the 29th of May, as Charles reached Blackheath on the edge of London, there were some 120,000 people. That's Charles II, that is. That's his entry into London at Blackheath. 120,000 people, an enormous number at the time, out on the streets to meet him, to greet him, to cheer, to dance, to play music, all of the razzmatazz of monarchy. Less than 30 years later, Charles's younger brother, who had come to the throne in 1685 as James II, a Catholic convert, made the journey in the opposite direction as he fled the nation in the shadow of the bloodless invasion, as it is known, of the Protestant Prince of Orange, invited to take the throne as William III, and to rescue, so it was seen, Protestant liberties. And in these decades, these 30 years, which is really what I'm going to talk about, we see oppression and liberation vying with each other, not only in the personalities of different monarchs, but also in the legal provision and the legal codes of the nation. What's known as the Clarendon Code of 1660 to 1662, which I will talk about later, contained some of the most oppressive legislation ever passed against Christian ministry. 30 years later, the Toleration Act allowed freedom of worship to independent dissenting congregations. Much happened in between, but our question really for tonight is, how did all of this come to pass? Well, the English Civil Wars, the Commonwealth, Cromwell's Protectorate, unleashed a stream of religious consciousness expressed in a wide variety of ways and through numerous different groups. And that quest for liberty had both political and spiritual origins. And if you remember last week, we looked at how the Puritan divines understood for us spiritually that essential freedom that we have in Christ. And it is in Christ that the true source of our freedom lies. However, we can't ignore the long-term political trends which also formed and shaped this period. And there are two in particular. I'm just going to note them, really. The long-term trends in religious liability really consist of two quests. Firstly, the quest for liberty from a monolithic state, and second, the quest for liberty from a monolithic church. And you could understand the Reformation partly in those terms. You could certainly understand Cromwell's Protectorate partially in those terms. And almost through the whole of this period of history, you have this double quest lurking underneath the surface. How are we to protect our religious liberties from an oppressive state? How are we to protect our religious liberties from an oppressive church? And sometimes, in some parts of history, that oppressive church has been the Church of Rome. At other times, particularly in the period we're looking at, it's been the Anglican Church, the established church. So, this is where we're going to go this evening. We're going to look at the restoration of Charles II. We're going to look at the Clarendon Code and the oppression of dissent. We're going to look at the Great Ejection. And we're going to look at the Glorious Revolution and the Toleration Act. So four sort of major things, really, which we're going to concentrate on. So the first of those is the restoration of Charles II. Charles II, a very different character from Charles I. His own complexities, which we'll come to in a minute, bit of a mixed bag, but very different from Charles I. Cromwell, of course, is a fascinating character himself, and I know one of the autumn lectures was focused on Cromwell. He is himself, of course, something of an enigma when it comes to religious liberty. But we've got to be careful we don't fall into eulogy or hagiography. This is what the American historian Tim Harris, who's written two great books on this period, actually. I don't know what his own Christian faith is, but he takes the Christian and religious aspects of this period very seriously and properly. So according to Harris, the execution of Charles I had culminated in a series of unsuccessful experiments with various non-monarchical forms of government in a desperate but elusive quest for stability until everything began to fall apart following the death of Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell in September 1658. The cold, harsh truth is that the people as a whole had never warmed to the idea of a republic. And it's also a cold, harsh truth, particularly for those of us who are kind of naturally sympathetic to the Puritan position. The truth is the people were tired of some of the more explicit Puritan restrictions. And the replacement of Oliver Cromwell with Richard Cromwell was nothing short of a disaster. And with Richard Cromwell's resignation in 1659, the only viable solution seemed to be the return of the old order. Now, the problem, however, was that the return of the monarchy was likely also to mean a return of the Anglican Church and its bishops. And as we will see, that was to prove problematic. Actually, bishops are usually problematic in any age, aren't they? If the truth be known. The end of the Commonwealth period was marked by a convention established in April 1660 to set the terms and conditions for the recall of the king who was in exile in the Netherlands. Now, this convention, in a relatively generous act of religious liberty, passed what was known as the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion. Great names for these Acts of Parliament. The Act of Indemnity and Oblivion in 1660, offering pardon for crimes committed against the monarchy over the past 2 decades. Now, I'm telling you this because what you've got right at the beginning of this period of Charles II coming back to the throne, you've got different things happening in tension with each other. You've got a part of Charles and a part of the Parliament seeking to recall Charles wanting a degree of liberty. And at the same time, you've then got pressure for oppression of any actual expression of religious liberty. It wasn't all one-way traffic. These things were in tension with each other. And Charles II himself actually wanted a degree of religious liberty. But he wanted to be the king again, even more. And at the end of the day, that's the trump card as to why at this point religious liberty did not succeed and did not win out. The same Act of Indemnity and Oblivion that offered a degree of liberty also provided for the exhumation of Cromwell's body and the bodies of various other members of the Commonwealth period who had died. They were to be dug up, they were decapitated, the corpses, and the heads were placed on spikes in the usual place by Tower Bridge, just as a lesson to anyone else. So you see, even that one Act of Parliament, on the one hand, tried to say we want to move towards a degree of toleration, but just you be careful, because if you step out of line, this is what we do. Now, rejoicing at the return of the monarchy in May 1660 was widespread, but it wasn't universal. There were a number of prosecutions of individuals opposing the king's return and some minor uprisings. The Puritan divine John Botts' sermon in Darfield Church in Yorkshire said this: "Fear the King of Heaven and worship him, and be not so desirous of an earthly king." That was a classic sort of Puritan Protestant position in the 1650s. But for the most part, Republican sentiment was passing. And the Parliament, which then sat from 1661, in order to finalise the terms of the settlement, contained within it at least 3 different groups. And it's worth just mentioning these groups because it will help us understand the tensions that there were and that it wasn't quite so straightforward as we sometimes think. And so there are 3 main groups. A small number of committed Republicans. The king would not be acceptable in principle, whoever they were. We got rid of the king. We don't want another king. We just don't want a monarchy. The reality is that was a small group. A much bigger group were the group of mostly Presbyterians and Puritans. They were similar, not necessarily the same. And basically, this much wider group of dissenters, so they generally, this wasn't the Anglican Church, by and large, this was those who had flourished under Cromwell and independents of one type or another, they generally favoured the restoration of the monarchy on limited grounds. And the third group were the ultras, the ultra-royalists, who thought it had been a mistake to get rid of the king in the first place, and therefore what would you do but have the king back, and the king should be restored with all of his powers without query or question. And what we see here in this period, this restoration period, is a tension between those who believed that the authority of the crown should be limited and those who wanted to see it strengthened. And even there, even just by describing it in that way, I hope you can begin to see as we build this picture how we're going to move to that period of greater toleration. There's already a tension here between those who thought the power of the king should be unlimited and those who thought there should be some limits placed upon it. To some, it seemed obvious that it was the parliamentary convention that had recalled the king, the implication that it was the parliament that was supreme, something perhaps akin to a constitutional monarchy. On the other hand, the Anglican loyalists tended to the view that the king had been restored by divine providence, and all that the convention parliament had done had been simply to acknowledge Charles's rightful position as king, all the way back to the divine right of kings. And the biggest area of contention was religion and religious liberty. Charles II did try to appeal to religious liberty, and in a declaration issued from Breda in the Low Countries in the Netherlands, 4th of April 1660, just before he came back, he offered a free and general pardon to all supporters of the Republic and, quote, a liberty to tender consciences. Well, how genuine was this appeal to conscience and liberty? Well, it's difficult to say, but there were undoubtedly some mixed motives. Charles did not have a particular wish to be oppressive, but he wanted to be popular. And at the same time, he desired the restoration of his throne with all of its attendant rights and privileges. Charles II is something of an enigma. He was intelligent, quick-witted, undertook significant reforms of the navy, was relatively popular among the populace. He wasn't especially religious, but he certainly wasn't an atheist, although over time he began to lean in a more Roman direction. But this idea of the merry monarch, which is how he's come to be known to us through history, too often led in the direction of debauchery. And so, Harris argues, although Charles II may have been less fit than Charles I, morally speaking, he was arguably more fit to be a king. That's quite interesting, isn't it? If you think about the debates we have about the election of political leaders today, when we worry about how you decide what to do, in fact, we might be deciding what to do now, you know, how you decide what to do in when people have different moral positions. Just replace Charles II by Boris Johnson and Charles I by Theresa May. Although Boris Johnson may have been less fit than Theresa May, morally speaking, he was arguably more fit to be a king. Now, the point I'm making is not a political point. The point I'm making is the complexity we face when, as Christian people, we're faced with political leaders who may fail our moral test. I hope you see the point I'm making. My American friends have the same problem with a certain Mr. Trump. So, the idea, the reality of the restoration of the church and state establishments were rather more brutal. There were attacks on Baptists and Quakers. The Anglican prayer book was restored, as was the Episcopal hierarchy. There was maypole dancing aimed at deliberately taunting the Presbyterians and the Independents. There were public burnings of the Solemn League and Covenant, which was the declaration of the 1643 Westminster Assembly in defence of the Reformed faith. And we should be clear also, though, that although the Presbyterians wanted a broader settlement, their own toleration did not extend to the real independents, the Baptists and the Quakers, who in turn appealed to Charles II's declaration from Breda of a liberty to tender consciences. So, again, the point I'm trying to make is, you know, everybody had a limit to where their tolerances lay. And even within those groups we might find ourselves most sympathetic to, there were boundaries. And tolerance wasn't going to be accepted in every direction. Michael Watts, in his book, The Dissenters, argues that Charles wanted religious toleration, but that he wanted the crown more. And so the reign of the first English king to preach the virtues of religious toleration was marked by the calculated and often malicious persecution of dissent. So again, we've got this tension going on within the establishment between a kind of move towards freedom and toleration and liberty, and yet at the same time, these expressions of oppression and dissent. Well, any such hopes of religious liberty were to be sorely disappointed. The Anglican vision won out, and a narrow and intolerant Episcopal Church was re-established, backed up by a severe penal code. A code known to history as the Clarendon Code. It's called that because its main author and instigator was a man called Edward Hyde, who was the first Earl of Clarendon, hence the Clarendon Code, but who was Charles's Lord Chancellor, Charles's Chief Minister, effectively his Prime Minister, from 1660 to 1667. And this series of penal laws was designed to guarantee an Anglican monopoly of office-holding, worship, and education. And the viciousness of the Clarendon Code was almost a last gasp of religious oppression in England, at least of the more explicit sort. The measures were aimed at all varieties of the Puritans, Independents, Dissenters, of whatever type, style, or description. Anyone who'd had any connection with the previous regime of Cromwell was a target, and in fact, anyone who'd dissented from Cromwell's regime was also a target. And there were four key measures passed by Parliament over these first 2 years of Charles II's reign that formed the basis for this highly oppressive piece, not piece, but highly oppressive code of legislation. And I'm going to run through each one. And the first of those was the Corporation Act of 1661. Remember, Charles II restored May 1660. Here you have an Act of Parliament within a year. Despite all that talk of liberty, despite all that talk of freedom, despite those declarations, the first thing he actually does is pass the Corporation Act. This Act required all municipal office holders, magistrates, mayors, councillors, parish clerks and parish officers, aldermen, and so on, anyone holding any form of civic office in England, to take the Holy Communion according to the rites and rituals of the Church of England. I'll just pause there. There's a bit more to come. But the first part was requiring anyone taking up those offices to take Holy Communion according to the rites and rituals of the Church of England. Now, the majority of independents, Presbyterians, and, for want of a better way of putting it, the more reformed sort of Anglicans, I suppose, but the majority actually were willing to go along with that. So most Presbyterians said, well, if that's the only thing that's required, that would be kind of okay. But the Act didn't stop there. The Act went on and said, and anyone taking up these offices must renounce the solemn league and covenant of 1643, which set out the defence of the Reformed faith. So you see the problem facing an independent Puritan or Presbyterian wanting to comply with the requirements of the restored monarchy. If you wish to take up office as a parish officer or a councillor to play your part in the life of the nation, you have to take Holy Communion according to the rites and rituals of the Church of England. And mostly they kind of said, well, you know, maybe we could do that. Church of England only required it three times a year, so they took the view, well, pop along three times a year and do it. But in addition to that, you must renounce basically everything you have stood for. And you can see why some would balk at that. So compromise wasn't enough. You must renounce everything that you have believed and stood for. And actually, round about 700 ministers left their posts at that point. I don't know how much you know about the Great Ejection, and we'll come on to the Great Ejection shortly. I think you may have had a lecture on the Great Ejection some years ago. You may or may not remember it. I wasn't here. But actually, one of the mistakes in the history of the Great Ejection is to think it all happened at one go. Actually, it didn't. The first phase was immediate, where a small number, about 700, left at this point. But even now, the majority of moderate Presbyterians and independents wished to remain within, let's say, for a better way of describing it, the broader sort of Church of England. But Charles wasn't going to back down from re-establishing the Anglican hierarchy with a degree of viciousness. And so the second act, 1662, the Act of Uniformity. Now, this act required all clergy and teachers from masters of Oxford colleges all the way down to private tutors employed by the squirearchy and the aristocracy, and anything in between. I mean, obviously, there wasn't state provision of schooling in those days. It was private schools, voluntary schools, charitable schools. But anyone in any form of teaching position whatsoever was required to conform, surprise, surprise, to the liturgy of the Church of England, as prescribed by the Book of Common Prayer, and to renounce the solemn league and covenant. So now it's moved from office holders to clergy and teachers. You see how this oppression is beginning to spread? How the tentacles are beginning to go out to all of those areas of national life? And just to make sure, a deadline was set for compliance, for the swearing of the oaths. And the deadline was the 24th of August, 1662, St. Bartholomew's Day. And that, of course, was the setting for the Great Ejection we will come to in a few minutes. Now, a particular problem was that the declaration of adherence to the Book of Common Prayer required clergy and teachers to give, quote, their unfeigned assent and consent. Their unfeigned assent and consent to the Book of Common Prayer. And I'll come back to that, because even though it's only a few words, it was a fundamental sticking point. But hold on to that. The third act of oppression was the Conventicle Act of 1664. This was building on another act called the Quaker Act of 1662. I mean, you can work out who the Quaker Act of 1662 was aimed at. Basically, what the Conventicle Act of 1664 did was take the oppression of the Quakers from 2 years earlier and apply it to anyone who was independent of the national church. It was initially intended to last for 3 years, but it lasted longer. And the Conventicle Act prevented more than five people meeting together for worship unless they belonged to the same household. Sorry, I will rephrase that. It prevented more than five people meeting together for worship outside of the parish church unless belonging to the same household. This was directly aimed at dissenters, nonconformist, independent Christians who were not part of the established church from meeting for worship. If I say no more than five people are allowed to meet together. And these acts provided for a series of fairly strong and escalating fines for anyone attending the meeting of an independent chapel, an independent meeting, an independent group, and so on. The first offence was £5 or 3 months. The second offence was £10 or 6 months. The third offence was £100 or transportation. These were pretty oppressive. Sort of £5 is kind of more like £500 today, and that was for the first offence. Their fines were reduced in 1670 for merely attending a meeting, an independent worship meeting, but for preaching at one or allowing your house to be used for one attracted extremely stiff penalties. £20 for the first offence, £40 thereafter, in today's terms, £2,500 to £3,000. This was quite significant sums. So the Conventicle Act led to a lot of oppression of independent ministers, and it was actually under the Conventicle Act that John Bunyan was imprisoned, and I'll come to that briefly in a moment. But firstly, let me put the fourth act up, the 5 Mile Act of 1665. Remember, the Great Ejection happened in 1662, and although we've not covered that yet, just note that that happened. The 5 Mile Act was designed to prevent. I mean, what would you do if you were an ejected minister from the Church of England? You might think, well, you know, maybe God will lead me to set up a new congregation outside of the Church of England. That would be a fairly kind of normal thing you might think a minister might do, but not according to the state. So the 5 Mile Act prevented ejected ministers from establishing new congregations by preventing ministers from residing within 5 miles of either their old parish or any corporate town. What they meant by that, what they were trying to do, they're trying to stop the ministers from either establishing a congregation with their old worshippers, as it were, and they were also preventing them from heading into the cities, heading into Birmingham, heading into London, and establishing new planted congregations in those places. That's why they were prevented from living within 5 miles of either where they had been or of any corporate town. So it was far more draconian than it sounds just by reading it out. And many suffered, hundreds of people suffered under these unjust provisions, including some of those Puritan divines we were mentioning last week. John Bunyan, 1628 to 1688, was prosecuted under a previous Conventicle Act, actually, but was in and out of jail for 12 years. This was explicit religious persecution and injustice. But we know that the outcome of Bunyan's imprisonment was that he wrote The Pilgrim's Progress. Surely one of the greatest works of Christian spirituality ever written. So it's a reminder to us again that even in these times of great oppression, even in times of depression, God is in charge. And God will bring great good out of things that are very oppressive and very bad in that sense. Well, I think it's probably just worth mentioning to summarise this particular section, that, and I guess you've probably picked this up, there were a variety of positions in relation to the restoration settlement. And there was a middle ground of dissent. And I suppose, I mean, this might upset the purists, I guess. I mean, I don't mean here, I just mean anywhere, you know. They might have, you know, the idea that not every independent Presbyterian or Baptist was absolutely pure in everything they believed and in everything they stood for wasn't the case. The largest group was a great middle ground of independents and Presbyterians who wanted the king to come back, actually. They wanted the restoration of the monarchy. They were willing to go along with most, but not all, with most of what was expected of them. If they had to sort of, use the Book of Common Prayer, the majority were willing to use it. Many people had, if they were not dissenters themselves, had relatives who were. Or if they didn't have relatives because independency was growing, they would have business relationships with those who were members of independent groups or congregations. And so you had this increasingly large middle that began to see that the persecution of those of dissenting or independent opinions probably wasn't really a great idea. So in the longer term, despite the extremity of the Clarendon Code and its restrictions on religious liberty, there was in fact a much more significant, broader group that came to see oppression as counterproductive and undesirable. And we'll come back to that towards the end. So that's the first two things I wanted to cover, the restoration of Charles II and the enigma that Charles represented, and then that oppressive period of the Clarendon Code. And thirdly, I want to tell you a little bit more about the Great Ejection itself. Now, the Act of Uniformity, passed by Parliament in 1662, was draconian and rigorous. Richard Baxter, 1615 to 1691, lamented that he said, quote, "A weight more grievous than 1,000 ceremonies was added to the old conformity with grievous penalty." The form of subscription required of ministers, who must now be episcopally ordained or reordained. If they had been ministers, had been ordained during the period of Cromwell's protectorate, if they wished to continue, then they had to submit themselves to reordination. Many were willing to do that, actually. But the oath to be subscribed required unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything contained and prescribed in the Book of Common Prayer. The quote from the oath is, "The unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything contained and prescribed in the Book of Common Prayer." You see, most independents, most Presbyterians, most those of reformed mind thought the Book of Common Prayer was quite good, but not perfect. And there were some difficulties. There were some problems. But mostly, they were willing to compromise. Until the requirement under law was to give your unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything contained and prescribed. Conformity to the Anglican liturgy, renunciation of the oaths of the solemn league and covenant were also enforced. All of this to be enacted on the 24th of August, 1662. St. Bartholomew's Day, recalling, of course, the French massacre of thousands of Huguenots in 1572, following the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. It was also the day, the 24th of August, that the tithes and rents which supported the clergy were due to be paid. This was entirely deliberate. If ministers did not conform and swear the oaths by this date, they would immediately lose those payments due on the 24th of August, leading in many cases to immediate impoverishment. Now, as I said earlier, some 700 ministers had gone right at the beginning with the Act of the Corporation Act on Charles's restoration, and now a further 1,000 or so were to face rejection. So again, you see what I mean? Like, you know, some went immediately. They couldn't take any of this. Others said, no, we're willing to compromise. But the state and the church were not willing to compromise. And so they said, well, we're not willing to go beyond that boundary. And with various others in the period, it is estimated that some 2,000 ministers departed one way or another. And in total, these expulsions represented 20% of the clergy of the Church of England. Well, who went and why did they go? Well, most of those who were forced from their livings in 1662 were, as I've indicated, moderate dissenters of one type or another, willing to accept the new king, willing to accept many of the imperfections of the Book of Common Prayer, but objecting to the unfeigned assent and consent and to the repudiation of what they had stood for. Some of these men were Baptists, some were Presbyterians, some Congregationalists, Independents. And so, for example, we have here a letter from an individual who we only know the letters AB. There's a lot of speculation over who it is, but we don't know. In 1662, that summarizes it rather well, really. States, there is as much fully to be declared concerning the Book of Common Prayer as possibly can be concerning the Book of God, the Bible itself. So do you see the point they're trying to make? Yes, we're willing to compromise. We're willing to use something that's imperfect, but we are not willing to say there are no imperfections. We are not willing to say it is perfect. The only thing you could say that was in that category is the Bible itself. And we're not willing to say that the Book of Common Prayer is of the same status and standing as Holy Writ. That was the essence of the issue. What were the objections to the Book of Common Prayer? Mostly, I mean, there was a variety, but mostly they were these. The use of the Apocrypha. I mean, actually, the Apocrypha was not normally used in, even in the Book of Common Prayer, but it was permitted in certain instances. So you get into the arguments about the nature of the Apocrypha. If you want a good historical row among evangelicals, discuss the nature of the Bible, discuss the Apocrypha. The evangelicals have been arguing about it for hundreds of years, and there was an enormous row in the 1820s when the Bible Society split over the whether or not they should publish Bibles, including the Apocrypha, or not. So this wasn't necessarily a new argument. If you want to hear that story, I'll have to come back another time to tell you. I certainly don't have time to do it now. So the use of the Apocrypha. Second, the baptismal liturgy, especially the sign of the cross and the assumption of regeneration. It is quite interesting, actually, that these issues with the Anglican provision have been the issues that have exercised the minds of evangelicals in every age about the Anglican provision. So there's only three or four things, but actually they are the things that have tended to exercise the mind of faithful evangelicals, not just in the century we're talking about, but down the centuries. And there was another famous case in the 19th century known as the Gorham case, where an Anglican minister was prosecuted for daring not to believe in the automatic regeneration of the child in baptism. And actually, his position was upheld in that case. But here, if you read the Book of Common Prayer, you can see how it could be interpreted as assuming the baptism of a child leads to the regeneration of that child. Well, no Reformed evangelical believes that then or now. Notwithstanding issues of covenant and all the rest of it, it's the regeneration is the point. Similar to that, the charitable assumption in the burial office of salvation. I remember taking a funeral in my first couple of years of being ordained as I'm ordained Anglican, as most of you probably know, really. But it's kind of, you know, I don't know how many of you are Anglicans or not Anglicans. I probably better not ask, but I'm not a very good Anglican, really. I'm not very loyal. And the sort of the reason I'm not loyal is all the things we're talking about, really. But I remember taking a funerals in my first couple of years of being ordained of non-Christians. I'm quite happy to take the funeral of a non-Christian. That's not an issue. What I'm willing to say at such a funeral is definitely an issue. And I would take these funerals at the crematorium in Southampton, and I would always preach, if I didn't know the individual, obviously you make an attempt to get to know the family a little bit and exercise a degree of compassion. That's just normal. That's just normal stuff. But I would always preach from John 14 and 1 to 6. And I would never make an assumption about the individual who had died. I would not assume they were saved. And I also wouldn't assume they were condemned. I would preach to the congregation that was gathered to give thanks for the life and so on and so forth. Unbeknown to me, the organist at Southampton Crematorium was an elderly lady who went to Above Bar Church in Southampton and who saw it as part of her Christian ministry to pay the organ, or the piano, I can't remember what it was, for funerals at the crematorium. And after several of these, I don't know how many, she came up to me one day and she said, "Oh, you know, can I just say, you know, you're one of the few ministers from the Anglican world who, when they come to take funerals here, actually preach the gospel." And that's the point. I didn't assume the individual. If you're going to assume the individual is saved, you end up saying all sorts of pious things without actually proclaiming the truth. And so one of the objections of the Puritans and the Presbyterians was this tendency of Anglicanism in their burial liturgy to assume that the dead person was saved, irrespective of other matters. And the fourth one, the general absolution. I mean, I used that on Sunday, I think. I don't think I have much problem with it. I mean, I've not checked whether the one I used was identical to what was in the Book of Common Prayer then. I mean, the general absolution in Anglican terms is really a prayer of declaring that all those who truly repent to receive mercy and forgiveness. Provided it says that, I'm okay with it. But there were some scruples about an assumption, I guess, about any assumption of general salvation. So, interestingly, it was a relatively small list of objections. And if ministers and others had not been required to give their unfeigned assent and consent, that there was nothing contrary to the word of God in the Book of Common Prayer, nothing, if they hadn't been required to do that, probably the history would be very different. But the state and the church required absolutism. And the faithful ministers were not willing, rightly so, to go beyond that boundary. And most of those facing ejection took the opportunity to preach farewell sermons, often the week before the ejection. My youngest daughter, Rebecca, who is 21, I think. How old is she? I have four children, and I have some difficulty sometimes getting the names in the right order. I certainly have difficulties getting the ages in the right order. So maybe she's 23 now. Anyway, early 20s. And she studied history and politics at university at Exeter, and was doing a dissertation. And she chose to do as her dissertation the farewell sermons of the Great Ejection. And it was a great piece of work that she did. I helped her with sources, but wow, I learned a great deal from reading what she had done. And she was able to go into far more than I'd ever been able to do so. So actually, some of the quotes I'm giving now are from my daughter's work on the farewell sermons of the Great Ejection. They were often preached the week before the 24th of August. Although in the case of Richard Baxter, he was going to be prevented from preaching his farewell sermon because the government sent troops to Kidderminster Church. So royalist soldiers occupied Kidderminster Church for at least 6 weeks prior to the 24th of August because the state establishment was so scared of the impact if Richard Baxter was able to preach a farewell sermon in his church. So what Richard Baxter did was preached it in London in July. That's essentially what happened. We have 77 such sermons which were subsequently printed. Themes of death and loss were significant, but it is also clear from these sermons that much more was at stake, not least the liberty to preach the gospel. I've been giving you all this detail. In essence, it's about the gospel, the boundaries, and the freedom to preach and proclaim the Christian gospel. A really interesting man who I didn't know very much about. Well, actually, I have to be honest, I didn't know anything about. Robert Adkins, not someone I'd come across, 1626 to 1685. He'd already been booted out from being the Dean of Exeter Cathedral in 1660 for complaining that the church music was crowding out the preaching. Oh, wow. Oh, it happened then too, did it? but he'd found another church. He'd found another living in St. John's, Exeter. But then, 2 years later, he was faced with these oaths, which he simply wasn't willing to subscribe to. And this is what he said in his farewell sermon. I beg that you would not suffer our nonconformity, for which we patiently bear the loss of our places, to be an act of unpeaceableness and disloyalty. This is a great quote. We will do anything for His Majesty but sin. We will hazard anything for Him but our souls. We hope we could die for Him, only we dare not be damned for Him. That's a powerful statement from Robert Adkins. So you see, there was a lot of reluctant nonconformity. But sadly, nothing was conceded by the state. The loss which pastors referred to in their sermons was, of course, the relational loss also a minister feels when torn away from his flock. But also, of course, the loss of the gospel when the pulpits go silent. Just to flag up where I'm going to end up in about 10 minutes at the end, with this period of the great Puritan divines, this tussle between oppression and toleration. Most of the Puritan divines died in the 1680s and the 1690s, and it seemed like the gospel had gone cold in England. 50 years later, Whitfield, Wesley, Howe Harris. We have to remember that God is in charge, but at the time, it seemed like the gospel was going cold. And it seemed like that for many of these ministers preaching their farewell sermons. How is the gospel going to be preached and proclaimed? Richard Baxter, in his farewell sermon, preached not in Kidderminster but in London in July, said, I will so far consent to your troubled thoughts of this unwelcome day as to confess that to me as well as you it somewhat resembleth the day of death. These were emotional. I mean, can you imagine sitting and listening to one of these sermons, the last sermon your minister's going to preach because they're being forced out of their posts, their living, their homes, and so on, resembleth the day of death. Thomas Lye, the incumbent of All Hallows, Lombard Street and the City of London, lamented the loss of the love and affection of his congregation and that he would not see them again until the day of judgment. Thomas Brooks feared that God was withdrawing the gospel from England. But then he recalled, it's the same point in a way, he recalled the ineffectiveness of all former attempts and designs to destroy the gospel. You know what endeavours of old there has been to darken the sun, to put out the light of heaven in the Marian days and in other days since. And yet it has defied prisons, racks, flames, pillories, or anything else to extinguish the glory of it. So again, you see, you get this tension. The fear that the gospel was being extinguished, but then Brooks remembering all previous attempts to extinguish the gospel in the past have ultimately failed. And nothing can prevent the advance of the gospel. William Bates, who was the rector of St. Dunstan's in the West, a church with a lot of history, St. Dunstan's. The evangelical rector in the 19th century was locked out of St. Dunstan's in order to prevent him preaching. But here in the 1662, I know you expect I should say something as to my nonconformity. I shall only say this. It is neither fancy, faction, or humour that makes me not to comply, but merely for fear of offending God. I'm sure most of you probably know, but just in case you don't, that the actual word nonconformity that is used today as nonconformist comes from this period. It's nonconforming with the requirements of these various acts. John Collinge of St. Stephen's, Norwich. The church's power, you've got to think about this one, the church's power is not authoritative as to give laws against the laws of Christ. It is only ministerial. What that means is the church does not have the power under God to pass laws that are against the will of God, against the Bible, against the teaching of Christ. It might have the power as an institution, that's what it means by ministerial, it might be able to order its ministers to do something, but it can't actually change the law of God. So, for example, the Church of England could choose to order me to conduct same-sex marriages. Same-sex unions. Conduct marriages of same-sex people. It could order me to do that, but it cannot change the law of God, as set out in the Scriptures, that that is not what God requires, expects, or permits. So at that point, I would have to choose, do I follow the instruction of my, well, they're not my employer, but, you know, do I follow the instruction of my church in their own regulations, or do you obey the law of God? That's the point that is being made. It's also interesting, I haven't got quotes from these, but the farewell prayers were interesting too. The last prayers of these ministers. And the prayers would include prayers for new ministers to come, prayers for the king. There was, it is said, never such a Sunday as this. But it was marked, by and large, by a serenity and a peace, a passing on, a lamenting, a bidding farewell. The assistant rector at St. Dunstan's, Mr. Herring, it is reported, read the prayers, closed the book, and noted to the congregation that this was probably the last time he would appear before them. Simple as that. Well, no doubt we could spend a lot longer on the Great Ejection, but we must move on to the last section so that we can draw to a close. And the last section is now just to move this forward into the next period of the arrival of the Prince of Orange and the Toleration Act of 1689 and the close of the period. And I suppose you've probably figured out so far that liberty ebbed and flowed under Charles II. Apart from the Clarendon Code, there were other periods during his reign, 1660 to 1685, during which oppression flourished. There was another Conventicle Act in 1670, which was a double-edged sword. It reduced the penalties of the Clarendon Code, but then it also removed the right of trial by jury, which conversely increased the pressure on dissenters. So if you were a dissenting Christian facing oppression from the state, and you had the right to appeal for trial by jury, you would always take up the right to take up trial by jury. And so although they reduced the penalties in 1670, they took away the right to trial by jury. 1664, 12 Baptists were sentenced to death for failure to conform. And they were saved because Charles II personally intervened to grant a reprieve. Life, liberty, and the state were all at risk. Now, nonconformists in this period, generally speaking, blamed the church establishment, the high Anglican interest in Parliament, and particularly the bishops for the oppression more than they blamed the king. And to a degree, they were probably right. I mean, it's not an either-or, but they were probably right in that respect, that that's where the real pressure was coming from. But the tide began to turn when it became clear again that the threat to political liberty, came from international Catholicism, international popery, as it was referred to. And this led many moderate Anglicans to increasingly doubt the wisdom of harassing Protestant dissenters. So, if we may put it another way, if the nation is under threat from Catholic powers overseas, why waste your time and energy suppressing and oppressing those who are going to be your allies in this cause? That's the kind of how the argument goes. 1672, the King, Charles II, issued a declaration of indulgence, exempting both Protestant dissenters and Roman Catholics from various of these penal restrictions. The problem was, in the atmosphere of the times, Charles II beginning to lean in the direction of Rome, his heir, which was his brother, the Duke of York, who was to become James II, who was a Roman Catholic, he was next in line to the throne. The problem with the Declaration of Indulgence is it was seen as too generous to Roman Catholics. And you see why that was. Well, James II succeeded to the throne in 1685 on the death of Charles II. Whatever view one takes of Charles II, his brother's reign can only be described as calamitous. He refused to call the Protestant-dominated Parliament, which stood prorogued for 3 years. 3 years, not 5 weeks. 3 years. And when he did recall it, he sought to pack it in his favour. He acted in favour of the Catholic interest and alienated almost everyone, including even the majority of the Anglican establishment. You see, the Anglican establishment, over time, although it had many problems, many complexities, many difficulties, was increasingly not Roman. And therefore, when a threat came that was Roman, even the Anglican establishment were going to resist the king. The king maintained a peacetime standing army. Now, that always raised suspicions. It's not like today where you have an army. In 19th century and earlier, if you needed an army, you raised an army. So you didn't generally, other than perhaps in London, have a standing army. James II maintained a standing army. That led to lots of suspicions that he would use that to suppress the people. He established an ecclesiastical commission to investigate Protestant clergy. 1688, after only 3 years on the throne, he was forced to flee. Now, Parliament offered the crown to William of Orange. But they offered the crown to William of Orange, who was married, actually, to James II's daughter, Mary. So James II's daughter, Mary, had married a Protestant prince in the Netherlands. And so that was the link to the English throne. They offered the crown to William, together with a Declaration of Rights, which eventually became the Bill of Rights of 1689. An assertion of the ancient rights and liberties. So what we're beginning to see is a shift. Parliament this time not seeking a commonwealth, not seeking to end the monarchy, not seeking a new Cromwell. They're saying actually what we need is a continuation of the crown, but with the protection of the rights and liberties of the people. So you can just begin to see this shift taking place. The terms of the Declaration of Rights was approved on the 12th of February 1689. Yes, it was 1689 that it became the Bill of Rights. And William and Mary were proclaimed on the 13th of February. Now, the Declaration of Rights declared that James had sought to subvert both the Protestant faith and the laws and liberties of the land, and that the Prince of Orange had been raised by God to deliver the kingdom from popery and arbitrary power. You can see the themes. A degree of freedom from both an oppressive state and a degree of freedom from an oppressive church. And we've moved over this century from the divine right of kings through to, yes, an experimental period of the Commonwealth, but through to actually a Protestant monarchy with rights and liberties enshrined in law. These were the themes, just run through these quickly, of the Declaration of Rights, which became the Bill of Rights. But the Ecclesiastical Commission to investigate the clergy was suspended. The king maintaining a standing army was declared illegal unless it had parliamentary consent. There was to be no suspension of law by edict of the king, again, unless parliament consented. There was restrictions on the king's levying of taxes. What a terribly good idea. Restrictions on the levying of taxes. We should continue that. there were to be free elections and frequent parliaments, and there were to be no excessive and unusual punishments. Now, some scholars say, oh, well, this was all sort of pious stuff that didn't really mean anything. Actually, I don't think that's right. I think it's not the pinnacle of freedom and toleration and liberty. It is a marker along the way. After this point, we were never as a nation going to go back to a Roman Catholic monarchy. We were never as a nation going to go back to the degree of oppression that had previously taken place of independent Protestant individuals. Clear movement in the direction of a lessening of restrictions, greater liberty, and so on. William then moved quickly to bring in a formal Toleration Act. Interestingly, this act retained some of the penalties of the penal laws and retained the Test Acts, and so in that sense it explicitly excluded Roman Catholics from any religious freedom, and it continued to prevent nonconformists from certain offices and entry into certain universities. So this is not a complete wiping of the slate clean. However, significantly, dissenters were given immunity from prosecution if they licensed their meeting houses and kept the doors open. Why do you think a law would say if you meet in a independent chapel, you've got to keep the doors open? Because the charge under the Clarendon Code was that all these independent Christians are really disloyal to the nation. And what they do when they close the doors in their meeting houses, they're not worshipping God, they're planning treason and sedition against the king. Well, it was never true. And one of the things I'm sure you've learned from tonight was actually most people in that position wanted the monarchy back. But actually, the way they dealt with it in the Toleration Act was say the doors must be kept open so that there could be no charge of the plotting treason in there. People subscribed to the Declaration Against Transubstantiation, well, that wasn't going to be difficult. Take an oath of fidelity and allegiance to the king. Generally speaking, nonconformist ministers would be happy to do that. And rejecting the Pope's deposing power. The Pope technically had the power to depose a monarch. That's what happened to Henry VIII. You can see now, it's never going to happen again. And what's more, just to make sure that all of these dissenting Christians are loyal, they have to agree that the Pope doesn't have the power to depose the King of England. You can see that wasn't going to be a difficulty. So you see we've made a move here of a clear direction. There's one problem, which I'll mention, and then I'll conclude. It was now legally permissible not to attend the parish church. But it was only legally permissible not to attend the parish church if you attended a dissenting chapel. So you now had two options to remain within the law: attend the parish church, Church of England, or attend one of these chapels. And I'll come to the importance of that literally in about 30 seconds at the end of my conclusions. So, we've seen in this period an ebb and flow of oppression and toleration, which certainly did move over time towards greater toleration within certain limits. When the Anglican establishment was in charge, as I hinted at earlier, the prime reason for closing down or oppressing nonconformist conventicles was they were seen as politically radical. However, the reality was that the overwhelming majority of English nonconformists were not political radicals. Most wanted to make peace with the monarchy, particularly if the nation was protected from Rome and dissenters were given freedom to worship. So let me just summarise the reasons for the move towards toleration and then leave you with that final complexity. So, the Glorious Revolution of 1688 secured the nation against Rome. You see, this isn't an argument that William III was the best monarch England's ever had and he was the greatest Christian monarch. I don't think that's the case. But politically, that settlement secured the Protestant nation against Rome. There would now be no going back in the other direction. Because of that, it was easier for the government to pass a Toleration Act allowing greater freedom for independent Protestants. Remember, many of the great Puritan divines died in the 1690s, the exact period we're talking about. And what happened, and this is the complexity I'm going to leave you with, that because the choice now was you attend the parish church or you attend a dissenting chapel, where did you go if you were effectively an atheist? You went to the dissenting chapel. So rather bizarre way in which this has got turned on its head. The faithful Puritans and Presbyterians and Independents, resisting the state, resisting the Anglican oppression and establishment, getting the freedom to establish their own chapels, found themselves being infiltrated by rationalists and freethinkers. Now, couple that with the death of the great Puritan divines in the 1690s, and you begin to get an explanation for why it seemed the gospel had gone suddenly cold. Why over the next 50 years it was seen as a dark age. If you look at the writings of Whitfield and Wesley and Hal Harris in the 1740s, they look back to the previous 50 years as a cold, dark age in which the gospel had sunk. Now, that might have been over-exaggerated, but the reason is we'd lost the great Puritan divines, and the advance of toleration had actually led to a much more mixed picture in our chapels as well as our churches. And when we get to the revival in the 1740s, Isaac Watts had enormous problems trying to encourage the independent chapels in the 1740s to realise that God was stalking the land again.
Anyone questions?
Can we ask what happened in the churches when the minister had to leave?
Yes.
Did they continue to meet?
Yes.
Worship?
That's a great question. Two things happened. Some left with the minister. Most just stayed, and waited for the next minister to come along. So it's a complicated picture, and the problem for those that went was because of all of this other oppressive legislation. It wasn't an easy decision to go, because where did you go? How did you find somewhere to worship free from oppression? So the majority did just stay. But not all.
Today, what sort of oath does a minister in ordination for the Anglican Church have to give? What sort of integrity?
Yes.
Because it was a severe yes. test of integrity in the past, but it doesn't seem like that now.
Yes, so the basic, that's another great question. So in today, what sort of oath does an Anglican minister have to give? So the oath you have to give on, there are two oaths, you have to swear on ordination and appointment to any post. First is an oath of loyalty to the Queen. The second is known as the Declaration of Assent, and it's a great oath. Of course, I can't quite remember it word for word standing here, but it's do declare my faith in the... Do declare my adherence to the faith as revealed, uniquely revealed in the Holy Scriptures. That's what it says. Uniquely revealed in the Holy Scriptures. Now, when I was ordained, there was a move that those oaths are sworn publicly. And when I was ordained, there was a move to make them private. And I was part of a and you won't be surprised to hear, a rebellion. That resisted any attempt to make those oaths sworn privately to the bishop in his chapel. And I would probably you know, to use an expression, die in a ditch, die in the ditch over those oaths being in public. Because the reason they're in public is every Anglican minister today is swearing that they believe in the faith uniquely revealed in the Holy Scriptures. The sadness, of course, is how many don't. But if they don't, they can at least be held to account that they stood in front of a congregation and swore it. The problems today in the Church of England are not so much, interestingly actually, almost the opposite of what they were in the period we've been talking about. In the period we've been talking about, the problem was the legal position, the oaths that had to be sworn. The problem today is actually the legal position is probably quite sound. The problem today are those who inhabit the posts that require these oaths of you, who appear so often not to follow the oaths that have been sworn, and that's the sadness and the and so on. I mean, what I was saying right at the beginning about, you know, these moves on abortion in some of the political parties' manifestos, right under the radar. You know, the Archbishop of Canterbury is first out of the blocks when it comes to sort of, you know, some equality issue or some sort of oppression of this, that, or the other. Maybe he's right, but where's the noise about the abortion? Why aren't the bishops all absolutely up in arms about it? So the problem today, interestingly, is more those who inhabit the posts than the legal requirements.
Question at the back there, towards the back, Jim.
I was really fascinated by the Clarendon Code bit, and it's really easy, for me at least, to see a parallel with that in particular lobbying that's going on at the moment, particularly LGBT stuff. First they came for the office holders, then the educators. In the Clarendon Code, the next thing was getting rid of the church and preaching the gospel. Where do you see that going if we continue the parallel today?
Yeah, and that parallel gets repeated in other centuries too. So in the 19th century, when compulsory state education, for example, was introduced in 1870, you know, my old friend, the Earl of Shaftesbury, railed against the introduction of compulsory state education because he said it's a godless system, he said, and this will lead to Christian teachers being pushed out of schools and it will lead to the Bible being pushed out of schools. And he was correct. And so in every age, the radicals will go for education. The radicals will go for church ministers because church ministers are teachers. And what radicals want church ministers to do is not teach the gospel. Just because you find yourself in a minority, just because you find yourself in a situation where everyone else seems to think something different, just because you're in a situation that looks monolithic from one direction only, doesn't mean the gospel is defeated. So everything we've learned tonight, everything we've been trying to convey, says there will be dark times and times of oppression, but that doesn't mean the gospel is defeated and that God will bring that gospel into new light, if you like. So we need to pray and raise up Christian teachers. We need to pray and raise up Christian politicians. We need to pray and raise up faithful gospel-preaching Christian ministers, and we need to be willing to stand for our faith in the public arena, even if we face some of those oppressions, with compassion, with love, not with nastiness and not with bigotry, not with being horrible to people, just faithful to the gospel.